Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy podcast. Today we're here with Mr. David Levine, co-chair of the Science Writers in New York, also known as SWINY. It's composed of editors and writers who cover science and medicine in both print and electronic news media, as well as public relations professionals who promote science. He can be found on Twitter at DLloydLevine, and he is a freelance health and medical writer who is known for many interesting and prominent podcasts with some of the most prominent leaders in healthcare media today. And with that, we'd like to welcome Mr. David Levine.
Thank you. I'm just adjusting my... Okay, thanks. Happy to be here. So I know you asked some questions. Do you want me to just go over them?
Sure, yeah. So we can begin with the first question. Essentially, Okay. Really starting from the beginning of your career to where you are now, how did you evolve into becoming a science writer? And like we discussed, I use the word evolve deliberately because it involves a particular trajectory to be a writer of science. And curious to see your story and how you came to be where you are.
It wasn't planned. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's in creative writing from Johns Hopkins. And I wrote plays and short stories, and it's not easy getting jobs doing that. So I, my first job was at a hospital, and then I worked for a cancer organization, and then the American Lung Association. And then I left there and I was freelance for a little while. And then someone told me that Pfizer was looking for some editors. So I was hired for one day to do a project. And I ended up staying there about 10 years.
Wow. So,
and then I decided to leave the pharmaceutical area, and I became director of media relations at the American Cancer Society. And then I was the head speechwriter and one of the crisis people for the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, which I imagine being a crisis person during the pandemic would have been really difficult. You'd be with the mayor and the New York City Health Commissioner, all the, you know, Harlem Hospital, Bellevue Hospital, all the hospitals that they have.
Wow.
So it wasn't planned, but you know, it's always been healthcare jobs.
Yeah. What's interesting about your career trajectory is that could be a play in its own right. Just the various experiences that you've gone through and kind of this narrative approach to healthcare, which is now starting to become more prominently accepted in mainstream media outlets. Why is storytelling so important in healthcare? What do you see that perhaps somebody who's more technically oriented in the sciences may not see?
I think storytelling is very important. I think people relate to stories. I mean, there's a little girl who fell into that well or so and hit the ground, and she was the complete focus of the news attention for 3 days. So, and I think also, I mean, last night when we were talking about bionic limbs, it was great to have, you know, I mean, there's a video on Nova where they tell the story about the person who invented them, and his personal story was he went mountain climbing and got hit by a total snowstorm, whiteout conditions, and he and his friend had their limbs amputated. And telling a story through a person or through, you know, a patient or a doctor or something like that makes it more personal. And, you know, I mean, every time a celebrity gets sick, there's a lot. When I worked for the American Cancer Society, every time a celebrity got sick, I got a million calls about, you know, how come he had this cancer. There's, and what about this cancer? What's new? And so I think, you know, telling stories through people is a great way for people to relate. And I think also scientists talking about their own personal experiences. So I've been to meetings, and I've been to the Lindell Nobel Laureates meeting, and where, you know, people who won the Nobel Prize, but they actually talk about their research and how they did it and the challenges and things like that. And then it's a little bit more relatable to people.
Yeah. It's almost that journey essentially becomes what people relate to, those struggles, the ebbs and flows that they identify with themselves personally.
I also want to add that I did the kind of the opposite of what most people do. I mean, most people go from journalism to public relations, and I've gone from public relations to journalism. So I've written for Scientific American, I wrote for the New York Times, I've written for Discover magazine, written for a lot of magazines. When I was working full-time, I wrote for women's magazines also. So, and there was always like a goal of mine to kind of, you know, have a journalism thing. And in terms of, you know, so these podcasts developed out of, I used to interview book authors at the New York Public Library. Mm-hmm. And that kind of came to, and then also at the home of Chip Fisher, who was one of the people who runs a company that makes the Fisher Wallace stimulator. And I met him, and his wife used to come to some of our, you know, book authors. We had people like Carl Zimmer, Sherry Turkle, and it was great interviewing people in person. But then Mrs. Fisher said that, you know, if you ever want to do something at her home, she has a living room that seats 100 people. Mm. I have a living room that seats about 3.
Yeah.
So we started, you know, and also that was, you know, a donated space, which is, you know, for any, you know, nonprofit, it's a great thing. And, you know, it's overlooked Central Park. I think sometimes people came because they're interested in the topic, but they also wanted to see what it was like.
Yeah.
You know, so that's been a boom. And then when the pandemic started, I was talking to my other co-chair, Joseph Bonner. He used to be the head of media at Rockefeller. And he said, well, I want to do something on Zoom. So I called Carl Zimmer, who's a friend of mine, and said, you know, you want to talk about your reporting on COVID? He said, I got a lot of free time. So we started, doing that. And I've interviewed people like Paul Offit several times. And he was on TV all day long. And John Moore, I've interviewed, who's a researcher at Weill Cornell. I've interviewed Gideon Gill of the Managing Editor of Stat, now twice, and Porta Manavilli from New York Times. And so I've gotten a lot of people. I've also, the nice thing about Zoom is I've gotten to interview people all over the world. And I did a panel with a journalist from Sweden, one from France and one from Germany. And that was, you know, very interesting, you know, to be able to, I mean, the two of them I had met, and it's very interesting to actually be able to, you know, have them as part of the experience and for them to talk about reporting on what's going on in their country.
Yeah, it's almost as if you're telling the story of the pandemic as you're living it. And that must've been a very unique experience.
It was, it was also a great thing for me. I live alone. I have two adult children. And I remember naively, you know, telling my daughter, who had a baby just two years ago, and said, this must be a wonderful bonding experience for you. She said, are you kidding? She said, I'd rather, you know, I trade places with you in a minute, you know. So I want my husband at work, want my her daughter going at school. She wants to run, have her babysitter back and have her cleaning lady and stuff. So, you know, I think the pandemic experience is probably toughest for, you know, young parents.
Yeah.
With children.
Yeah, I could imagine a lot of people can relate to that sentiment where you have this complete disruption in your schedule, and it's almost a disruption breeds additional chaos. Mm-hmm. You have been very active with quite a few individuals throughout the New York City area. You mentioned Dr. Moore, but really there's quite a few other individuals in combating vaccine misinformation. One of the initiatives was with Dr. Moore in leading a letter to Spotify requesting the company to implement a better misinformation policy. Can you talk a little bit about your efforts on combating vaccine misinformation and why that's so passionate for you?
Dr. Moore, this is a letter written by someone, but Dr. Moore really, you know, helped to promote it and get all these people to sign on. And I said, I'd like to interview about it. We've also, you know, the journalists I speak to, we also talk about the misinformation. I mean, you know, one of the reasons I don't let people talk during the broadcast is I sometimes get people who are, you know, saying, you know, your vaccines are killing people, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, I think it's very important. Vaccines save lives. I mean, I think there's an estimate that, you know, the vaccine misinformation has killed 65,000 to 75,000 people. I'd have to check the exact figure. But I have a cousin in Arizona, and I was talking to him, and he was, and you know, I just couldn't believe it. He was saying that the vaccines have poisons in them, and that he wouldn't take it. And then he said, you know, he said, I trust my immune system, and I also don't think the government should tell me what to do. And I said, well, first of all, you got COVID already, so you know, so trusting your immune system didn't really work out. And I said, do you wear a seatbelt? Do you stop at traffic lights? He said, because these are all laws that you people do. And I remember Francis Collins of NIH saying that when people tell him that, you know, they don't want to take the vaccine, he said, you know, he said, we have great trauma rooms. We have great emergency room doctors. We have great surgeons, you know, if you're in a terrible car accident, but why don't you just wear a seatbelt? And that's what I feel about vaccines as well as masks. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, it's been going around viral that Governor DeSantis was mocking, you know, at a press conference, he was mocking students wearing masks and telling them you don't need those.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and that, you know, and for me that's amazing. That's incredible, and I was, you know, and it's very hard, you know, for a student to really, you know, talk back to a governor or to not follow a governor's orders. Just as, you know, in medicine, you know, when a doctor recommends a test to you, you might think, well, do I really need it? But it's very hard to go against what a doctor says to you.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of, I mean, I think the doctors have really been heroes during the pandemics, not only for the, you know, the long hours and the work, but also that, you know, because they have patients who are, you know, my own internist was saying, she has people coming to her and saying, I don't want the vaccine. I'm going to wait for, you know, a pill I can take if I get COVID. And her answer to them is that vaccine has been given to would you rather take a vaccine that's been given to millions of people throughout the world, you know, and very little side effects? Or do you want to take a new medicine that's, you know, no one's really taken and just got authorized for emergency use, and we don't know what the side effects are? So, you know, but so I think vaccine misinformation is in some cases deliberate. There's political advantages, you know, that some people have to it. But it also puts scientists on the defensive and, yeah, you know, the medical professions, and it's very difficult. It's a very difficult, I mean, and I think it's also, you know, when people say the science is evolving, well, that's what science does. Yeah. I mean, you know, vaccine requirements change. I mean, the vaccine for children is not working for the 5 to 11-year-olds is not working that well. They gave them a third of a dose of the Pfizer vaccine, and they're going to adjust that. But it's mm-hmm. like, was that, you know, a plot? Was that a conspiracy? No, it's just, you know, they didn't know. And now we do. I mean, years ago, they said that ulcers were caused by stress, and now we found out that ulcers are caused by bacteria.
Yeah.
And the doctor who said they were caused by bacteria was mocked. He actually induced an ulcer in himself, swallowing all this, you know, terrible cocktail, and he ended up winning the Nobel Prize. So science does change because facts change. You know, we know the Earth is round, and but vaccine hesitancy. You know, when we spoke to Dr. Moore, I mean, it really started with the MMR vaccines and people claiming that, you know, it's caused by, you know, it caused autism and all these things. And we even have one of the Kennedys, Robert Kennedy, you know, he's one of the vaccine leaders, you know, fighters. And there was only one scientist that, you know, who found that connection. And he ended up admitting that his data was faked and that I think he actually went to jail. And but the trouble is once a paper is retracted, it's still floating out there and people can see it.
You know? That's interesting, talking about these pre-publications, the retractions, you know, data that's too preliminary. A lot of people, rightfully and wrongfully, blame the media. And I can see both positives and negatives in that argument, but I don't feel that the concept of blame applies to the pandemic because it's such a systemic problem. What are your perspectives on that intersection between media and science, journalism and healthcare that worked well for the pandemic and maybe didn't work well for the pandemic?
Well, I think that people want a simple story being told.
Yeah.
And this is not a simple story. I mean, you know, things have changed, you know, guidelines change. And you know, the media reports, you know, if a guideline changes, I mean, I know that, mammography guidelines have changed. And people say, oh, you know, well, why are they changing? And they said, well, because we found that, you know, it's better to start, or colon cancer, it's better to screen a little 5 years earlier because there's been increases. So that's understandable. But when guidelines change all the time, and they're just guidelines. I mean, every governor is putting into effect in their state different guidelines. And so that, I think that confused the people. And, you know, even in New York State, I mean, yesterday they ended the mask requirement in New York State schools, but New York City is keeping them up until next Monday. And people are saying, well, why? You know, what, they don't understand. It's just confusing. And then, you know, I think the booster shot problem was, some people, you know, many people have gotten the two boosters, but that you need to get the third, the two vaccines, but you need to get a booster. And the amount of people getting vaccines in New York City is like 85%, but the booster rate is much lower across the country. But that's something people really need. And I think people get confused because they're saying, well, the two vaccines were supposed to prevent me from getting sick. And I think that people didn't understand that the vaccines were not designed to stave off all infections, just like flu, but it was designed to keep you from going to the hospital and dying.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, I lived near Lenox Hill Hospital. I mean, people were dying. They were, you know, their blood oxygen levels were dropping, and they couldn't even bury people. Bodies were just piling up. Luckily, we have a less virulent strain. But I think, to answer your question, I think that it's not always a straightforward, we're living it at this very time. I mean, if I was, you know, writing about the Spanish flu, I could write about what happened, you know, and report on it. But if I was reporting on the Spanish flu in real time, it went away. I said, well, no, that's great. It looks like it went away. I mean, last summer, July 4th, the president was ready to declare a national victory.
Yeah.
And then Delta came. It's not his fault. You know, he didn't know. You know, nobody, it's like the Monty Python thing. Nobody's expecting the Inquisition.
Yeah.
And I think it's a hard story to tell. And then, you know, because there's so many different levels. I mean, you know, we have people who are against the pandemic in New York City. We've had crime against Chinese Americans because, you know, President Trump said that he called it the Chinese virus. And so there's a lot of anger. I mean, I can understand people don't want to be restricted, but, you know, the United States has never had the lockdowns that other countries did. I mean, in France, if you wanted to go out during the height of the pandemic in March and April 2020, and France is a little bureaucratic, you had to print out a form or have it on your phone which says, I'm going to the drugstore, I'm going to the grocery store, or I'm going for my half hour of exercise. And that would be printed out. And you could only go, I think, 20 miles from your home. And if you were caught, you got fined. I mean, in the United States, there's not one, nowhere in the United States did they tell, were people fined for being outside. Nobody was told you can only be outside half an hour. We didn't like, you know, have soldiers like they did in China, you know, in front of people's homes. I mean, my niece in Canada had gallbladder surgery, and she tested positive for COVID, you know, and when she went home, she got a phone call saying, we're just checking on you and making sure, you know, you were supposed to quarantine the next 7 days, making sure you're home. She said, well, I am. She said, well, why don't you come to the door and show us? We didn't have that. Wow. We didn't have that in the United States. So I don't think people in the United States, you know, realize, I don't know if we're luckier than they are, but, you know, we didn't have those really, really hard lockdowns. I mean, Australia was the most lockdown country of all. Yeah. And other countries are, you know, everyone says the pandemic's over, but other countries are thinking, you know, it's running rampant through New Zealand. Hong Kong is thinking of locking down again. Denmark got rid of all restrictions and they have very high rates of COVID. And you still have, you know, the majority of people in Africa and other countries not vaccinated.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's the story isn't over. And, you know, we do live in a, you know, we don't live in the, you know, medieval times where people don't travel.
So. Yeah. I want to ask you an admittedly unfair question, but I think your insight would be really valuable. The concept of the pandemic is inherently complex and uncertain. And you mentioned it doesn't fit that convenient narrative. Is it simply that the pandemic was so unique that traditional journalistic techniques could not fit or work? Or was there something in the way we wrote about the pandemic or the stories we tried to create in the moment that led to a lot of the vaccine hesitancy or seemingly self-defeating or counterintuitive behavior in the pandemic?
You know, I think the pandemic, well, for many people covering it, it was a unique story, but for other people, I mean, who covered Ebola and who covered SARS and MERS, I mean, we've had other pandemics. We've just never had one this extensive. And also, you know, and affected everybody. So, but we also never had a pandemic where we had a vaccine in within a year.
Yeah.
But I don't think journalism failed. I just think journalism was telling the story as it was happening. And again, I think journalists did a very good job telling the story.
Yeah.
You know, but it's tough to fight misinformation. It's tough when both scientists and the media are not as highly regarded as they were. I mean, mm-hmm. I did a story about the one of my guests was he won a Pulitzer Prize writing about polio, and he was saying that, you know, Jonas Salk went to the White House. He was hailed as a savior of humanity.
Wow.
You know, and, you know, polio is something that, you know, it was a very visible disease. I mean, you see the way people walked, you see, you know, and it was really scared people. And people were very grateful to scientists who did it. I mean, Larry David talks about, can you imagine being Jonas Salk's mother?
Yeah.
And, you know, so you hear about my son Jonas? You know, that guy, you know, everyone made fun of. He invented something. What was it? Oh, yeah. He cured polio.
Yeah.
How's your kid doing?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a time when science, my dad worked for NASA. I mean, I don't think any, there was any time, you know, that science was more, you know, rooted for in the 1960s, when the astronauts went to the moon.
Yeah.
And the astronauts, you know, who I spoke to, they said they were very careful to say that this is a accomplishment for all of humankind. We did it. He said, the United States didn't do it. We did it.
Yeah.
And I think that was a very unifying moment for the whole world. And it was, the astronauts who were in space talk about a worldview where they look at the globe and say, why is anybody fighting? Why is anybody, what a beautiful world we live on. There was also a time when people, everyone remembered who can remember. I remember watching with my dad and sister and mom, and it was so exciting, and you were so proud of the country, but you're proud of mankind. And instead of the pandemic, we have Republicans and Democrats arguing about things. We have people arguing about mask mandates. We have, I think that is new. That is something new, and that's the story that's been told.
Yeah. Do you ever see American society coming back to that level of veneration for science and for just healthcare in general? Or do you see that we're kind of on a unilateral track in a way where misinformation and kind of almost disinformation will become the norm?
I think it depends. I mean, I think the vaccine hesitancy is selective. I mean, certainly, parents get their kids vaccinated against polio. They get their kids vaccinated against measles. They're required in most schools, but also they know it's a smart thing to do. I think that, I think people want to, fly airplanes that have pilots who are trained.
Yeah.
They want them built, planes that are built by engineers, not just anyone can do it. I mean, they don't want to build by a Rand Paul who just says, I know more than you do.
Yeah.
I don't think he knows more than, the people, the engineers at Boeing. And I don't think he would say that, I don't think people would say, I'm doing my own research and I'll build a better elevator. You want an elevator that's built by someone who knows what they're doing. So I think it's very selective.
Yeah.
I don't think it's, I don't think people are, I don't think people are anti-science totally. I mean, they want to be, people still like having traffic lights. No one's saying take them down. People want, buildings inspected and stuff like that. So I think that, I think that this was it was kind of unique. I mean, yes, there were new vaccines and everyone's worried about it, but you have people that I knew who were desperately trying to get the vaccine and, on their computer, on their smartphone, on their tablet, on their browser, getting up at 5 a.m. looking for that first appointment.
Yeah.
Then you get other people saying, there's no way I'm getting that vaccine. So it's all, it's a very different experience for different people. But I think that, ultimately, I think people are the vaccine rates have gone up. And I think the World Health Organization says 65% of people have gotten the vaccine.
Yeah.
In the world, which is pretty good. But that's also in the United States, we're still at 65% of people getting two doses. That hasn't moved in months.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you look at kind of averages and how these numbers trend out for global population and American population, you almost implicitly create stories on the trends. You start to say, well, perhaps the story of rising global vaccination rates is a story of access, and the stagnant vaccination rates in the United States is that of hesitancy. Do you see it that way? Or do you try to parse it more into the granular details in the numbers?
Well, I did interview someone who was in Africa, and he was saying that in Nigeria, only 4% of the people are vaccinated. But he said, we know how to deal with small. And he said that, a lot of the times we get a vaccine, there's only a month left on its expiration date.
Mm.
In the United States, I mean, it's very easy to get a vaccine now. I mean, they're advertising it. You can just walk in and get a vaccine. I think it is a story. But also in Africa, the Pfizer mRNA vaccines, You have to keep at a certain temperature. There are transportation issues. I mean, you know, I've written about, you know, just drug distribution levels where it's trying to distribute drugs in Africa is very difficult because some people don't even have phones. Just moving things around. So, but I think that, you know, when the vaccine started giving out, the United States was way ahead of other countries. Europe didn't even start, and now they've surpassed us.
Yeah, it's interesting, particularly in certain European countries where there's a more uniform acceptance of the vaccinations, you can see those trends just escalating upward when a significant portion of the population receive it.
Well, they also have national governments. I mean, which, you know, it's not up to a governor whether or not to give a vaccine or the head of a district or county. I mean, smoking regulations, because I worked on that with the Lung Association, that was done state by state, city by city. New York City was the first to pass a comprehensive smoking law in 1988. And, you know, so in Washington, D.C., you couldn't smoke, but you can go to Virginia and smoke, which is 5 miles away. But in France, in Italy and other places, when they banned smoking, it was a nationwide ban. It was all the same day.
Yeah.
I think it's a better approach. I mean, you know, if you have someone like Rob DeSantis, who's obviously a strong supporter of vaccines or regulations. I mean, I was in Florida, and they don't check your vaccine card if you're going to a restaurant. They don't ask for that. You know, people aren't wearing masks. People aren't wearing masks in grocery stores. And I mean, New York City, if you want to go to a theater, if you want to go to a museum, if you want to go to a restaurant, and also in Europe, you have to show your vaccine card. And I mean, I think I feel better about it. You know, I think it's a good thing. I think that there is a, you know, dichotomy. And I think that, you know, worldwide, there's still a lot of people who have not been vaccinated. And part of that is that, you know, some of the vaccines that they thought would be, you know, distributed well, like AstraZeneca, really didn't. And I mean, Johnson & Johnson, I don't even think they're making their vaccine anymore.
They quietly discontinued a few months ago.
Yeah, I know. And getting very vaccines are easy to distribute and do not require all the problems of the mRNA vaccines. So that was part of it. And and also money, you know. So.
Yeah, it's interesting, all these factors going into the overall outcome of vaccination rates. In many ways, they are a series of narratives that culminate into an ultimate decision to get the vaccine or not to get the vaccine. As a journalist in this space, do you ever feel a certain obligation to correct the narrative, or is it more your responsibility to tell the story as it is while being keen not to influence the story as it's developing? How do you see that from a journalist standpoint?
I don't think it's my job to tell a person whether to get vaccinated or not. I mean, I can, you know, my family, yes, I can recommend things. But I think it's just to tell, you know, the story of what's happening of it. And I hope, you know, that, you know, I am nudging people towards it by just saying these are the advantages, and the advantages are very clear. And here are some disadvantages. You know, some people can't get the vaccine. And then there are people, you know, who I've offended, who's immune compromised. He's had 3 vaccines, and he had these very sophisticated tests where they show he has no antibodies.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. So I think I just try and tell the truth. And, you know, and if I'm not trying to shape, you can't really shape the truth, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to tell the story the best I can, but I am, you know, certain I'm not interviewing, you know, Rand Paul or people like that to hear their side of the story. Because, you know, I mean, everyone says that there's always two sides of the story. And I think that in this case, there is not. I mean, I think there are some facts. I mean, the earth is round. I'm not going to interview people in flat earth society.
So. What's interesting is kind of how almost as though so many became these convenient philosophers, where they tried to distill this sense of truth into subjective opinions. And you see that most prominently played out in phrases like speaking for science, let the science speak. Is it fair to use those terms, or is that a certain way of lending credibility to the person who's speaking? It's almost very controversial now, when it seems that statements should be relatively simple.
Well, I think that scientists, you know, first of all, are humble and say they don't know everything.
Yeah.
I remember once we were doing a show when I was at American Cancer Society, there was a book that came out called The Secret, which was a big bestseller. And they also made into a movie and talked about that. If you surround yourself with rich people, you'll become rich. If you have happy thoughts, you won't get cancer. And this is on 2020, in the American Cancer Society. And the person who was president, they asked him, you know, can you wish away cancer? And he said, they want you to say no. not to give a long explanation. And he was giving a long explanation that, you know, some people do get better, you know, even when they don't go advice. And he said something I thought that was very profound. He said that a lot of people who don't think it's going to work, it does work. You know, the drugs do work, or the treatments, whatever, you know, radiation, that they do get better.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I said, they really want to hear that. You know, they want to hear you say, no, you know, you can't wish, you know, surrounding yourself with fat people doesn't make you fat. I mean, that, you know, anyone knows that's not true. You know, and surrounding yourself with rich people doesn't make you rich. People know that's not true, but they say that, you know, surrounding yourself with people who have cancer is going to give you cancer. Most people would say, well, I don't think that's true, but they do say with cancer treatments that, you know, it's, you know, the cure is, you know, the cure is worse than the illness.
Yeah.
And I mean, I give Donald Trump some credit. I mean, I'm not, you know, where he said he because he discussed the, you know, the mental health aspects, you know, that were occurring. And that was a big thing in the World Health Organization announcement yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, of the staggering rates of depression and anxiety that are still going, you know, 25 to 30% of the entire rural population. And that's something he mentioned. And also, just recently, he started saying, yeah, I did Operation Warp Speed, that was mine. You know, he's finally, you know, saying, yeah, I'm proud of that, you know. So I got a booster shot. So that was something he did not do. But, you know, everything else he did, you know, I mean, promoting hydrochloroquine and all these other, you know, strange treatments, you know, really, I think really did a disservice. But it'd be nice if he really came out and said that people get vaccinated.
Yeah, particularly given the influence that he has. It's, as you alluded to, interesting to kind of see the take he took as president and the position he's now taking late into his post-presidency of existence. So I often wonder, when you talked about the subjective belief and confidence versus objective truth, whether we can simplify that into terms like placebo effect, or just be kind to one another, or if there's something else a little bit more deep, a little more fundamental that we could potentially take away from what we've seen in the pandemic.
Well, I think one disappointing thing to me is that you think that during a pandemic, when there's a crisis, that people would unite. You look at Ukraine.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone, you know, is supporting Ukraine. You know, you see all these positive messages on social media. The president of Ukraine is a folk hero. And it's a very clear, you know, good versus evil story. I mean, here's a guy who had no one had much expectations for and was actually pretty unpopular, who had a background as an entertainer. Yeah. And he's risen to this great statesman. And Putin, you know, is kind of everything that's you thought about him is true and even worse. And you're seeing world, you know, I mean, you're seeing airlines saying, you know, I mean, all these, you know, boycotts you're seeing by, you know, corporations, and you're seeing all the countries in NATO, you know, and the United States, they're freezing assets, they're condemning this. I mean, there was a vote in the UN, only 100 of all the member nations, only 5 people voted against it. One of them was Russia.
condemning it.
So, you know, I would like to see that with the pandemic. That would have been great. Can you imagine a world where everyone said, oh, great, we're all going to get vaccinated. Oh, great. Here are our wonderful scientists. Instead, people like Dr. Fauci get death threats.
Yeah.
And his family. And, you know, the only death threats for the president of Ukraine is coming from Russia. It's not coming from anyone else. And people believe in him. I mean, people want a hero. And yeah. For a while, Fauci was a hero. For a while, Cuomo was a hero for just, you know, every day he would get on and talk about, you know, the pandemic. And they said, how come we don't take a day off? I said, well, the virus doesn't take a day off.
Yeah.
And he was very popular then. You know, unfortunately, other things happened. But, you know, Fauci became a folk hero. There, you know, you can buy bobblehead dolls of him. And now, but then there are people with, you know, who, like Rand Paul when he's in the Senate and all these things. He has to actually defend himself against ridiculous accusations.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to see how Dr. Fauci and the perception of him has evolved over the course of the pandemic. And it, yeah, in many ways, kind of gives credence to the notion that there was deliberate misinformation from certain parties towards the others that would then kind of tear people down when we needed to build them up. And I feel that the politics of the pandemic is an easy source to blame for that. Mm-hmm. Would you agree, or would you say that there was something else in the pandemic that made us uncharacteristically divided when, as you alluded to, there's power in unity?
I think that, you know, there is a mistrust in science. I mean, African Americans certainly have a right to have mistrust in science because they were, you know, given syphilis.
Yeah, Tuskegee experiments.
Yeah. But actually their rates are now pretty high.
Yeah.
Mainly because a lot of African Americans are more prone to being ill, but they also had, you know, their church leaders, their barbershops, and all kinds of things, their social communication. So I think that you know, people have done a good job of communicating it. I mean, you know, the fact that we've had 65% of Americans, you know, with 2 doses of the vaccine is still pretty good. It's not great. It could be better. I mean, I would like to see the booster shot raising from 30% to 40%. I think the mandates, you know, if you're going to lose your job, you will get vaccinated. I mean, I know someone who is an anti-vaxxer, but he was out of work, got a job, and they said, well, get a vaccine. So he got a vaccine. So I think, you know, I think it's not, you know, these are not easy questions to always answer. I think there certainly was a political element. And I don't think anyone set out, though, to have a, you know, political addition to vaccines. I think people were very frightened by the virus. I mean, people hadn't seen anything like it. Everyone knew someone who had it. I mean, in the beginning of the pandemic, certainly people were dying, there were bodies being built up. I had friends who were afraid to get their mail. They would just, get it and they would let it sit for 3 days. People were washing vegetables, people, weren't, seeing other people. They were just staying in their homes. And, again, I don't think, we're not really meant to be that way. Humans are social animals.
Yeah.
So, and then you had people who just went about their business, whatever. So, I think, I think it was very frightening in the beginning. And then I think when people are really, really frightened, they are very compliant with health regulations.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, so March 16th, I believe, 2020, everything shut down. And the week before, they started offering, a friend of mine's in the Philharmonic, and he was saying that he noticed that attendance was dropping down every performance the week or two before it. And then they started offering, they said, next, we're going to give any Broadway ticket for $50. And then they shut down. I mean, the shutdown was, but they shut down everything, that Monday. And you couldn't go to a restaurant. You couldn't go to a, you can get takeout, but they wouldn't let you in. I mean, a friend of mine told me she was walking with a friend and friends and said, this is about as far as we can walk because there were no public bathrooms even open.
Yeah.
So I think that in the beginning, people were very scared and, were very, I don't think they resented it because they saw people dying and the numbers were pretty staggering and it was visible.
It was certainly a once in a lifetime experience. And I think looking forward now, almost kind of looking in a more positive way. And I want to leave with this one question, kind of leave with this one final question.
Sure.
Looking positively and looking prospectively into the future. As a healthcare journalist, as an influencer in your own right, interviewing prominent leaders in the intersection of healthcare and media, what positive lessons do you think we have gleaned from the pandemic that'll serve us well in the years to come?
Okay, tough question.
Sorry.
That's okay. sorry, just clear my voice. I think the positive things we've learned is that science can do amazing things. I mean, there's still no vaccine against AIDS, HIV, but, within a year, we had 2 vaccines, and now we have even more vaccines, and that's unheard of. We've also found drugs that were effective, really effective. I don't mean, like hydrochloroquine, but actual, medications that have been proven. And we've also, had people, actually, listening. I mean, there were daily White House briefings about the pandemic.
Yeah.
And, with Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, and yes, there were a lot of constraints, and the Trump administration, but we got the vaccines. And I think that's a very important thing. In the future, I think that in the future pandemics, I think we're going to be better at predicting them. I mean, one thing is looking at wastewater, which is something because a lot of people aren't very compliant about giving samples. But, in prisons and colleges, people use toilets and you can check wastewater. I mean, wastewater helped determine that the pandemic in the East Coast came from Europe and the pandemic in the West Coast came from Asia. And that's very, very important. But we need to do a better surveillance. I mean, one thing in the United States we failed on was contact tracing. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that people will, that the governments will be better at predicting the next pandemic. I mean, even Obama had a task force to do it, but never really did anything.
Yeah.
And I think the government did a good job. And I think that people, especially in the beginning, I know in New York, and I'm sure all around the country, people every day at 7 o'clock were applauding healthcare workers.
Yeah.
And I would like to see more of that. You know, there was one actor who would sing every day at 7 o'clock to the healthcare workers. He was a Broadway actor, Brian Stokes Mitchell, who got COVID and recovered.
Wow.
And they do a little concert for people. And I think that's a spirit that I would like to see more of.
Yeah.
In terms of future pandemics, I think we need to become better predictors. I mean, you know, every flu season, they look at what's the prevailing strain in China when they're making the vaccine. Unfortunately, the flu vaccine is still grown a very old-fashioned way in eggs, you know, and it takes a while. And a lot of times there are, you know, as we have learned, you know, viruses mutate. So by the time you get a vaccine in September, it may not be as effective as, it'll give you some protection. But I got the flu once, even though I had the flu vaccine. But I had a very mild case. I didn't have a high fever. I didn't have body aches. I just felt tired. And I think that's the experience now with people who are getting COVID, even though they have both vaccines and a booster. They're tired. They're coughing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they're not dying. They're not in hospitals. They're not on ventilators. So I think that's a great improvement.
Yeah. No, it's certainly lots of positives to take, lots of positive experiences. And as you alluded to, I hope that we appeal to the angels of our better nature moving forward and see that value in that unity.
I pray for that. I think that would be great. You know, I mean, I think it's a better world. I mean, I'd rather live in a world where everyone is rooting for Ukraine than everyone's, you know, than fighting over whether you should wear a mask or not.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Levine. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate your insight. Appreciate the conversation and look forward to hearing more from you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to getting to know you. And I know we've been corresponding on Twitter.
Yeah.
So it's been great. It's great to actually see you in person. And thank you for all the work you do.
Well, thank you, sir. Likewise.